This is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news and intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversations. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the management and staff of Guardian Radio.
Good evening, Bahamas. This is Bahamian urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto, and in the studio today I have my co-host who was absent 2 weeks in a row due to emergency surgeries. I hope his phone doesn't ring and have him run out the studio to try to save somebody's life.
But good evening, Bahamas.
Dr. Wesley Francis, Bahamian surgical oncologist and general surgeon.
It's good to be back.
We are very pleased to have someone who is held in the highest esteem in the medical community in the Bahamas.
Yes, she is.
And that is Dr. Christine Parker Curling, who is an internist and endocrinologist extraordinaire.
Extraordinaire.
She's here to promote her book.
She's
an author, a best-selling author.
Best-selling.
So we're here, always we want to promote positivity.
We always
hear so much negativity in our community. The crime is overwhelming, the corruption, et cetera, et cetera. The economy is in shambles. But we're here to speak about positive things, uplifting things, and things that are being done that no one would really know unless we bring it to light. So this is a forum to do that. We're going to speak about positivity in terms of health. So this book is extraordinary. I'm not always the avid reader, but I couldn't put it down. It was something that touched my heart. The name of the book is Beyond the Knowledge, The Power Steps for Doctoring with a Human Touch. Welcome, Dr. Christine Parker Curling. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on. Thank you for the great introduction. It's very humbling. And yes, I think you mentioned already that professionally I am an endocrinologist and internist, obesity medicine specialist, and I spend a lot of time talking and building relationships with patients.
Well, I think a lot of persons don't even really understand what an endocrinologist does. Let's start with that.
Ah, okay. So an endocrinologist is a physician, an internist who subspecializes in the study of hormones and glands and their functions. And most commonly, we would be dealing with patients who have conditions concerning insulin, like diabetes, or abnormalities in their thyroid hormone, or disorders of pituitary and adrenal glands. The latter two people won't think about unless something happens. But I think everyone has pretty much heard of diabetes and thyroid disorders, cholesterol, you know, low bone density. These are the things I see probably on a daily basis.
So you're the sugar doctor. So
yeah, actually. Yes.
So let's even before we get into the book itself, let's talk about an overwhelming problem. We always speak, Dr. Francis and myself, about non-communicable diseases, the ill health of this society. We're getting unhealthier generation by generation. A lot of what we're seeing in terms of alarming statistics relates to your specialty. So we're talking about obesity, going to childhood obesity, the number of persons who have prediabetes and diabetes, both male and female, are overwhelming. The number of persons who have thyroid disorders, which there are numerous, persons who have obstructive sleep apnea related to low testosterone, etc. So tell us why, as a society, obviously we don't have the best diet in the world. We basically have a sedentary lifestyle. We don't have enough sidewalks for us to really be active. We drive everywhere. We consume too much in the way of alcohol. We have too much peas and rice and potato salad. But why do we have an overwhelming number of persons who are either diabetic or pre-diabetic?
Okay, so I think you hit the nail on the head in many ways when you talked about the lifestyle choices and cultural norms that we've managed to establish in our communities. So basically, we experience excessive consumption of calories, specifically sugars and starches, rice, potato, bread, pasta, corn, juice, soda, energy drinks, you know, and these things give us an abundance of calories or stored energy, but we don't do enough to burn that energy. So what we end up doing is storing it. And unused energy is stored as fat. And fat interferes with the ability of insulin to work well to control your blood sugars. And so you end up in a scenario where the foods that we are eating are impairing our ability to metabolize the sugars that we consume. And the foods that we're eating are worsening the sugars in our bodies. And so it's kind of a self-perpetuating problem. So I think we also have not normalized walking. Like you say, when you see people walking, I once had somebody I was caring for tell me that walking means a couple of things in the Bahamas. It means you have no other way of getting around, or it means you might be having some struggles with your mental health, and therefore they won't walk because they don't want anyone to think any of these things about it. But culturally, in other scenarios, walking is the main means of getting around from place to place within reasonable distances. But we don't do it a lot. And we consume very dense amounts of calories. We drive through. So we drive to the place. We eat a lot of calories. We don't do any exercise. And we teach the behaviors to our children.
And what is the role of genetics? And I know we're primarily a nation of African ancestry. Does that play a role? I mean, do Black persons, male and female, get hit harder with hypertension, diabetes, and obesity because of their race?
So genetics is going to give you predispositions. And sure, genetic backgrounds can give you predispositions to developing certain metabolic conditions. However, I cannot support the idea that the primary problem in our population is genetic. I would have to still lean on the evidence that shows that the primary problem that we are suffering from is environmental.
And I mean, the Bahamas is not Nassau or New Providence.
Right.
It's not just Grand Bahama.
Right.
It's an archipelago of many islands. And we have a lot of very healthy persons in the family islands. They have a different lifestyle. They, in terms of what they eat,
absolutely,
in terms of their activity level, longevity is a common occurrence in Long Island, Cat Island, Rum Key, et cetera, but not the same here. What is it in terms of how can we turn the tide? Obviously, lifestyle changes, behavioral modifications, dietary advice, et cetera. We need to start from young. Obviously, obese children are going to turn into obese. Teenagers are going to turn into obese adults. We can turn the tide from as many as 40% of our female kids being obese. Let's get that number to less than 10%.
Yeah, I think the things that we're going to have to do to stem the tide of, you know, increasing rates of excess body weight and obesity and chronic non-communicable disorders is going to have to be multi-pronged. So education, like you say, we're going to have to start promoting the consumption of water, substituting these for sugar-sweetened beverages. So get rid of the sugar-sweetened beverages. You know, drink more water. I'm not going to get into controversial areas like taxation on sugars and unhealthy foods where people feel that their rights are being, you know, kind of impaired. But I would say that there is going to be some role from the governmental and health sector that has to be considered.
And I mean, unhealthy snacks are cheaper than healthy snacks.
They are,
and
so
that's a crying shame.
Are we to subsidize healthier options?
I think that'll save money.
Are we?
On the back end, in long term. So obviously, we're going to reduce the burden in our society as individuals get older in terms of dealing with hypertension, diabetes, and the morbidity associated for the effect on the workforce in terms of days off and sick leave, et cetera.
Right.
You're many times in their prime, we're having middle-aged or even younger persons taken away from being the primary caregiver for their family. Mm-hmm. So that destroys the family in itself. And we can't allow that to be perpetuated. So we're going to talk about the book. The book is very fascinating. It's a book for anybody because it speaks about your experience. You were very transparent And that is very meaningful. We talk about being a better physician. A lot of your lessons in terms of personal skills and being compassionate can be extrapolated to other fields as well. So I think it's a wonderful book in terms of anyone who's any profession, because a lot of the life lessons that you've learned and you're imparting can improve someone professionally, maybe improve them in terms of their social skills, et cetera, et cetera. And I think you've also given a lot of insight in terms of what does a physician go through. I think there's a lot of misconceptions in society. Physicians, yes, they go to school for a number of years. They don't know the hell that you go through. The other day I was speaking to a very senior orthopedic surgeon who's very well known in society, and he said for all the money in the world, he would never go through studying for final exams for his consultant orthopedic degree, because that living hell is beyond words. It's profound. I mean, the stress is
I'm sure he loves his lifestyle.
Everybody loves their lifestyle, yes. Because important thing for children and for young adults and teenagers is choose something that you love.
Right. It's about about what you love and how you can impact your community.
I mean,
there are individuals.
There's some studies that have said that as many as 70-80% of individuals, and that includes in the Bahamas, don't like what they're doing. They only do it to survive.
Well, yeah, but I think we ought to focus on the people who love what they do, because I mean, you see the difference in anyone when they have an internal drive.
We have a call coming in.
We have a call already.
Yes. Okay. Good evening. This is Urologist Speaks.
How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you.
Yeah. I mean, we could say everyone must eat good and this and that and all that, but if the government don't drop the duty on food for us to eat good, that's the biggest problem in this country right now. You go to the food store right now to buy a healthy dish, a healthy food for your family, you will overspend the money you're making in your household. Understand where I'm from?
You're very correct.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Yeah, so that's how the system been designed for so long. And see, what I realized, they go on to build a next hospital right now. You could build five hospitals in this country, and more people will just fill it up if you're not teaching these, especially from the school. Like my daughter goes to a certain school, top notch school, and when I go pick up, they outside, the teachers them outside selling candy and cupping and all the different things. So.
Yeah.
You have to teach these kids from small, and that's why it happened. If it was me, I grew up watching mommy cooking peas and rice and macaroni and all, everything is starch, everything this and that and all that. But I started to Google things and started to do things. And when I started to get regular checkup and thing and all that, I realized my father, he have cholesterol problems.
Mm-hmm.
This and that, he had strokes and everything and all that, and then when I checked myself, my cholesterol was going up too.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know what I mean? So what I did, I just changed my whole life around, just basically growing certain things and just eating, you know, making moringa tea, drinking a lot of ginger, and my cholesterol used to be 280 something. But I started drinking a lot of ginger tea early in the morning and sometimes in the evening times, and then I used the apple cider vinegar. My cholesterol went down, straight down to 205.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so you are correct. You know, it probably would be wise to reconsider what we call breadbasket items. What do we decide to reduce duties on? What do we decide to subsidize? But also, I think when I walk around, let's say, the farmer's market on Gladstone Road, and I go through and get things from the Bahamian produce, you know, people who are growing Bahamian foods locally, we're getting good quality foods, we're getting them at significantly lower prices. So we probably have to reconsider where we go to procure these healthy options. So I agree that in you know, on average in grocery stores, if you want to have a colorful plate with all your fruits and vegetables, it is disproportionately more expensive. So we probably have to be a little bit more creative about what we grow and where we source our items. And I think, you know, subsidizing or supporting the Bahamian farmers is going to be, you know, it's going to have positive effects for the consumer and also for the vendor.
I think you're spot on with that. Because, right, I mean, the caller did mention that he grew his own stuff.
Right.
Right? And I think that's where we need to focus on, incentivizing people to grow, incentivizing farmers to produce enough for us to be able to then consume those items rather than importing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the locally grown things are actually, they're nutritious, and they're more affordable. And I think that's the direction that we need to go.
And then not only with farming, we have to talk about the use of pesticides and insecticides, right, and hormones in our chickens that we grow, mm-hmm, and everything else. We need to try to promote organic. Of course, organic's very expensive. But if we were to promote as a nation organic eating, we would have a healthier nation. And it would save the government in the long run in terms of not having to have all these persons falling ill from all these non-communicable diseases, filling up the beds, and et cetera.
You know, the other day I visited a place out, it's near Albany, and the guy there gave me some eggs. And he said that they have, they purchased some layers from Abaco Markets, or Abaco, mm, you know, the place in Abaco where they sell these chickens. They were the tastiest eggs I've ever had. So, you know, homegrown things, I think that's the way we go. We have to incentivize and improve our own product. And we Bahamians, our consumers, we should start to consume those. The more we consume local products, the more farmers would be incentivized, right, to even grow them.
To produce.
Right, and to produce. And I think that's where we go.
I think we have to change the mentality of the society, because we always think for everything in our life, foreign is better. And that includes food. We need to support our own. We need to support our farmers. We need to be self-sufficient in terms of feeding ourselves.
Absolutely.
But there's not enough of that. We need to promote our self-reliance in terms of food.
And I'll pop in here also when you talk about when we think foreign is better. I think it also is going to shift what we consider to be normal. So when we look at the locally grown foods, or let's backtrack it. When we look at possibly genetically modified fruits and vegetables, when we look at things that are created to appear beautiful and, you know, visually pleasing, we start to condition ourselves to think that this is what, I'll use an apple,
better, right? Yeah.
This is what it's supposed to look like. So then when we see a naturally grown, let's say apple, just for the sake of the example, we say, well, I want that have spots on it. Well, I don't want that banana. The peel look brown. So I'm not saying that I'm also not one who has had to call myself into kind of subjection and say, well, what are you doing? Because I'm so used to going in the store and seeing this thing look so pretty.
Right.
And I think that that's what it's supposed to look like. And so I reject what might be more nutrient rich and what might be healthier, because it doesn't have the poster presentation that I've been, you know, conditioned to look for.
Right. No, that's true.
Let's talk about this fascinating book.
Oh, okay.
Yes, go back to the book now.
Beyond the Knowledge: Power Steps for Doctoring.
Thank you, caller.
With the Human Touch. So tell us, what inspired you to write this book? Because I know you're exceedingly busy. You have overwhelming number of patients to see and to care for. You're a mother. You're a wife, and you have an extended family. And your time is always very precious. First of all, I'm amazed on so many levels that you had the time to write this, and it's a beautiful read. But what inspired you to read this book, to write this book, and what is this book essentially about?
Okay, so that is a great question. The answer is very long, so I will try to kind of summarize it. I would say that I was a year or so ago going through a period of self-exploration, discovery, you know, self-improvement, and trying to figure out, well, what's next? What am I supposed to do next? Not that I was not satisfied with the way or with the capacity in which I serve. I'm very satisfied with how I get the opportunity to serve my patients, but I felt that there might have been something more that I was supposed to give. And I shared with you before the show that at that point, I was, you know, doing a lot of reading, a lot of introspection, listening to a lot of motivational speakers and preachers. And something stood out to me that in my listening to some of the recordings of Dr. Miles Monroe, and he talked about the graveyard being the richest place on earth, filled with, you know, books and songs and posters and paintings and just so many things that you thought you should have done or knew you should have done, but for varying reasons decided that you shouldn't do it. You're not good enough to do it. Nobody would listen to what you have to say. You wouldn't be able to do a good job. What if they don't like me? So there are all these narratives that we tell ourselves that stop us from kind of going further and what purpose, you know, what purpose we could be fulfilling and what we could be filling and what we could be leading others to do. So I thought to myself, well, what do I do well and what can I help somebody else to do well with that could help somebody else, that could continue to have kind of positive repercussions? And I thought about my relationship with my patients. And the thing that came naturally to me was, well, what do people say to you? Well, how do you know what you're good at? Is either something that you do naturally, something that you would do if you weren't paid for, or something that other people always see as something you're giving to them, even when you weren't necessarily trying. So I would say feedback about people saying, well, when I come to you, I feel like I could talk to you, or I feel like I could tell you this, or I, you know, those types of things made me wonder, well, what are the things that make someone feel that way? Are these things teachable? And is there any evidence to back up the things that I was saying would help to be things that would build a physician-patient relationship or any communication relationship? So as I went and made the list of the things that, you know, enhanced this relationship, I also, you know, looked up for papers to see, well, did anybody else do research about this area of communication? And did anybody else substantiate the fact that this is a good thing? So that was, in a nutshell, what made me do it and what made me choose the topic and what made me explore this particular part of life that I could help other people to do.
Well, very, very well said and very inspiring. We have a call coming in. Good evening. This is Urologist Speaks.
A pleasure. Good evening, Doc. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Thank you for the call.
And you and your guests. You know, growing up, we have many sayings. But we also say, thank God for social media. Thank God for the advent of computers and handheld cellular phones and communication in general, where in 5 seconds you could talk to your friend or your son or your daughter in China.
True.
I wonder, how did that happen so quick? With the use of the stratosphere, hit a signal on the satellite, it bounced to China and bounced back to you within a second or two. The old people used to say, somebody's garbage is another man's gold. So when you come on Wednesday with your medical show and telling us about the prostate and diabetes and high blood pressure, we might say Sparky talking foolishness, but somebody waiting to hear what you have to say on Wednesday evening. You understand where I'm coming from?
Yes, I thank you.
If we didn't have these talk shows in the evening, if we didn't have these cellular and social media, we might not have known nothing about these. Only thing we know that daddy was dying from some illness and the doctor say he ain't nothing much he could do. When doctors say anymore. But now we can find out within a minute that he go to see the doctor Wednesday morning and come back and doctor his test is such and such. Daddy has prostate enlargement or daddy has prostate cancer and now we got to work on getting rid of it. Or if it's stage 4, 5, 6, whatever it is, it's too late. So we got to thank people like you, us, and also the talk show callers that call in and so forth that spread their ideas around from one to the other. And we also got to say thanks to our religious leaders, social leaders, political leaders. But I hope we all just remember that this is one little community called the Commonwealth of the Bahamas, the third largest economy in the Western Hemisphere next to America and Cuba. And we got to protect this for the Bahamians. Stop selling this out to foreigners. Stop selling everything out to invaders and illegal people. Because we are spread it not like one island like Jamaica and Puerto Rico and Cuba and the rest of them. We are separated by many islands, a lot of water. We can't even fly to some of them. We got to wait by boat and so forth. We have to protect it for us. Before we know it, we will be overtaken by foreigners because they know the value of the Bahamas. They know the value of our natural resources, and they are coming for it, you know. They're not coming here because they love us. They come in to take what we got. And if our leaders decide to sell out and disregard what we want, in a few years from now, Doc, when your children go to Canada to school, they can say, thank you, Daddy, but I ain't coming back home. I have nothing to come back home to because the leaders sold it out for gold and 30 pieces of silver. Have a good day.
Thank you. Thank you, Sparky. I think that's already happening, and we know it's already happening. Yeah. I mean, as young professionals, relatively young professionals, we've been back for a while. We see many of our colleagues. Right. I don't know what percentage don't come back, but it might be more than 50%. So we can only imagine where our nation would be if all of these persons with these wonderful skills, all this training, all this knowledge came back and contributed to society. But you can't blame them. It's not easy coming back. We won't get into that. But if you have a love for your country, you're going to put through, you're going to go through all the hardship to try to see a better tomorrow. So we're right here. We only have one life to live.
Yeah.
Let's live the best life possible. Let's make sure that we live as long as possible. And let's stay away from negativity. And that negativity may take the form of food, junk food. It may take the form of sugary food, sugary drinks, excess alcohol, cigar smoking, cigarette smoking, vaping, negative company are going to get us going nowhere. We've spoken in the past of school children, particularly young boys, really not emphasizing the importance of education. Then our nation's not going to go anywhere if half our youth do not believe that education is important. In fact, it's frowned upon, and they are basically bullied because they do well academically. I mean, where is the what is the mentality of the society? We have another call coming in.
Yeah, we got a call.
Good evening, this is Urologist Speaks.
Is that me?
Yes, go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, pardon me. Good day to the talking away so long with you, Doc, and of course your guest. Sparky, amen, 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 amen. Doc.
Yes, sir.
Let me ask you something. Do you know whether or not that the government has people or teachers that goes into the schools to teach children about good eating habits?
Yes, I mean, there are, even when I went to school so many decades ago, there were nutrition classes, and they did speak about the importance of nutrition. But it's one thing to read in the book or to listen to your teacher give you a lecture. You got to live it, and part of that is what you see at home and what you've grown up to know. So if you have unhealthy eating habits from the age of 5 years old, you're fighting a losing battle by just having some nutrition class in the class.
There are some people who has the opportunity to get food, good food, and give food to their children at home. But there are other people out there, you know, they just eat just what they could afford. And, you know, I saw one evening, I mean, of course, I cannot see this. This is Bremen. One evening, I passed a place where this little young fella, he could have been no more than 11, went and bought cold cut just to go to bed on. And, you know, that put me back to when I used to go to school. When I used to go to school, I reached home about 3:20, and my old lady, she already had food cooked waiting, you know. So somebody, you know, this is some system in which we have.
I very much agree. We're losing the middle class. There's a greater divide between the rich and the poor in the society. It's in the past you could have one. Usually it was the mother stay home and take care of the children, but now you need to have a two income in a family just to make it, just to barely scrape by. You can't rely on one income for the vast majority of families, and that's unfortunate because many times children come home and there's nobody home. No one there to help them with their homework, no one to help them get a healthy snack, no one to prevent them from going on the streets and getting into who knows what, or finding love and acceptance that they don't have at home in a gang. But what are we going to do when economics are getting worse and worse, where the cost of living is getting out of control, and just to rent a place, I can't even say how can a middle class person actually buy a piece of land and actually build on that land? That's a dream that very few are able to attain in this society, and that's it's very disappointing. But we can't continue this way.
So it's a good time to segue into the elements of this book, right? And, you know, in the book, you have a theme. And this theme is the care. Kind of elaborate, what does care mean for you as it is outlined in the book?
Oh, okay. So the book is organized. I suppose the chapters are grouped together according to the CARE framework, which is an acronym, which stands for compassion, awareness, responsiveness, and engagement. And it just talks about, you know, the general components of any relationship. And I might even use one of the callers' example, even though that's not why they call. When we talk about compassion, awareness, responsiveness, and engagement, we're talking about remembering that the person that you're treating is not a diagnosis, it's a person. The person has a circumstance, the person has a social standing, the person has, you know, other scenarios or other factors that dictate how they accept your message. Be aware of the signals that are coming back to you. Being aware and being responsive to the signals coming back to you allow you to know if how you are speaking to this patient is being received. Are they understanding what you're saying, or are you just busy giving your blurb? And finally, being engaged with the patient allows you to pick up on signals that might redirect what you're saying. For instance, you might say, you know, well, anyway, your diabetes is bad, so I'm going to prescribe this medication. I want you to take it for 3 months and come back with this blood test and see how you're doing. But if you're engaged with the patient, you might have picked up some signals that perhaps this medication might have been a little bit expensive. Or you might say, well, you know, I gave you this prescription 6 months ago. Why is your number not better? And you might see the person shift in their seat. Right. And you might say, well, anyway, when you decide to go take this pill, then you come back to me. Or you might say, well, why did you shift in your seat? What about taking this pill was difficult for you? And they might say, doc, I went to the pharmacy and I couldn't pay for it. And that's why I didn't take the pill.
So they got to make choices between pharmacy and food and eating.
Pharmacy and food, right.
But I think because we have NHI, a lot of that doesn't exist anymore.
True.
And that's something wonderful the government has done.
Precisely. So in that scenario, you might redirect what you decide to tell the patient to do. You might say, actually, there's a version of this drug that's on the National Drug Prescription Plan. Yeah. I'm going to withdraw this prescription and ask you to go take this.
For free.
But if you were not engaged with the patient to pick up on their body signals that they might not even have been comfortable telling you that that's why they didn't take it, you miss the opportunity to meet the patient where they were.
So you talk about listening, active listening as a component in the book. Tell us how important that is for us as practitioners as we engage with patients.
I think listening is important in any communication relationship. In fact, as practitioners, it's especially important for many reasons. The one I outlined just now, listening to what the cues are, listening to what the patient is actually saying. Sometimes as doctors in our, you know, abundance of experience, we sometimes think we know what the patient's going to say. And so sometimes we cut them off. We're like, oh, I know what you're about to say. Anyway, you just need to take this. Whereas if you listened, you might have discovered that they weren't going to say exactly what you thought they were going to say. So it just reminds you to be patient and to take a moment and not interrupt the patient so quickly, but allow them some time to express what's actually going on.
Yeah, it speaks to how important that encounter is and also a relationship that you develop with patients. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, primary care is all about relationships.
Yes.
I think we've kind of commoditized medicine in a sense. You know, we like executive physicals. We want to do this, just scan everything, right? And we miss things because that relationship is what is important. Tell us about your own personal journey as a physician dealing with patients in the Bahamas and how you navigate that. Because, I mean, you write so much in this book, right, for all of us to learn. But I'm sure it was a personal journey. Tell us about that journey that you went through.
Well, first of all, for those who are just joining, we're talking about the book written by best-selling author Dr. Christine Parker Curling, who is one of our own, a Bahamian endocrinologist and internist. And the name of the book is Beyond the Knowledge, Power Steps for Doctoring with a Human Touch. And I highly recommend this book.
It's a great book. It's a great book. It's more than just medicine.
How do people get the book? Let's start with that.
Okay, so the book is available on Amazon. Locally, though, the book is available at the All Seasons, All Occasions Book and Gift Shop that's in Palmdale Shopping Plaza. It's also available at the Oasis Bookstore and Coffee Shop in the Miles Monroe Diplomat Center at on Carmichael Road. And also, if you know, if you reach out to us for bulk orders or, you know, autographed copies on the Instagram page or the Facebook page is Beyond the Knowledge. And the Instagram page is _ Beyond the Knowledge. Then we could arrange, you know, how to get those copies to you. You could call the office too, 325-6284. We'd be able to accommodate you.
So a lot of your personal experiences are tailored, obviously. You worked in the U.S., you were in Jamaica, now in the Bahamas. I think that you have a unique perspective looking at the different ways that people deal with medicine. One thing I found that a lot of patients who in the past, or they may even now still go away for their annual physicals, will say that Bahamian physicians on the whole have more empathy. They're more approachable than the ones they go abroad to see. And I think that's an important thing that we should never lose, because we're all a family here. Everybody knows everybody. Yeah. But then there's that counter where we have to stress that although everybody knows everybody,
right,
we have the utmost confidentiality in everything that is said to us. It never leaves the confines of the office, because that's all important. That is the cornerstone of our practice. And that's the only way that we're going to be able to help patients, by having them open up to us and feeling confident that whatever they say is going to stay within the confines. So even if you see somebody in a restaurant, a food store,
right,
I see it all the time. This is a small island.
Right.
I'll nod to them. I'll say good evening, or they'll usually say hi, doc, and I'll just say hi. But they'll never know, or whoever they're
right
with will never know that they have that relationship with me, because that's all important, that it's a confidential. We'll speak more about this on the other end of the break.
Guardian Media Group and Going Places Travel wants to take you on a 7-day cruise for four to Panama, Colombia, Curacao, and Aruba on Royal Caribbean Serenade off the seas. And here's the best part. No visa required. That's right, no visa required. You have four ways to enter, four ways to win. Number one, fill out the form in the NASA Guardian. Number two, listen to Star 106.5 and Guardian Radio 96.9. Number three, follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Number four, or make a purchase at any Going Places Travel. Entry deadline is June 27th, 2025. Drawing will be taking place on July 4th, 2025. So you know what that means? Pack your bags and get ready to soak up the sun and feel the ocean breeze. You and three loved ones sailing the high seas on a vacation cruise of a lifetime. Brought to you by the Guardian Media Group and Going Places Travel. Certain conditions apply. Airfare, taxes, and gratuities not included.
Always on the go? Missed the show? You can now listen to Guardian Radio talk shows anytime, anywhere on Spotify and YouTube by searching Guardian Radio 96.9 FM or by entering the name of your favorite show. You can also listen by logging on to guardiantalkradio.com and clicking on the podcast tab. Guardian Radio, continuing to provide you with fresh news and smart talk anywhere, anytime, all day.
Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Welcome back. This is Bahamian urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto and my co-host Dr. Wesley Francis, Bahamian surgical oncologist, and this is Urologist Speaks. We have in the studio best-selling author, our own Bahamian, Dr. Christine Parker Curling, endocrinologist and internist. And we're talking about her wonderful book, Beyond the Knowledge, Power Steps for Doctoring with a Human Touch. So you're speaking a lot about your personal experiences, and it's a different landscape here. As he said, it's a very small, close-knit community. Everybody knows everybody. Everybody wants to keep the confidentiality.
Right.
That's of paramount importance. And it's also important in terms of who do we hire? Who do we have from the receptionist to the cleaner to the nurses? They also have to have that same idealistic view that this is a confidential environment. We have to make sure that we have all safeguards in terms of everything is basically electronic now, that only certain persons can access information, and then there's an electronic trail that you know
right.
that someone who that only those persons that should have accessed that information are able to access. Everything is password guarded, et cetera. So your information is your own. There's no need for you to keep something to your grave and suffer needlessly because you feel that's an embarrassing situation. What is your experience in terms of that? Are people reserved in terms of not wanting to open up because of this small society that we live in?
Yeah, I think it's a good segue into the point you made about people tending to seek care abroad, those who can. And I think one of, you know, for many reasons, for varying reasons, culturally and, you know, I suppose the perception of having access to these better, quote unquote, better things. But also I think some people could genuinely, legitimately have a concern that their information is not protected, that their, you know, their medical concerns are fodder for general talk. But, you know, I would venture to say that the majority of physicians are very respectful of your privacy and your right to confidentiality. And I think sometimes it might take a visit or two or three. It might take a couple of visits.
Yeah,
sometimes it happens in one.
Yeah.
To figure out this relationship, to decide that you trust this physician and the facility. And then you can make a decision about your ability to let your guard down. So I think establishing that relationship and especially making the patient feel comfortable and making them reassured that their information is, number one, important, and number two, confidential, is paramount to kind of continuing that relationship. I think along those lines, too, when we compare, like you said, well, just a little comparison about, you said something about when patients see physicians abroad and at home, they have different experiences. Well, the experiences will be different, good and bad, you know, pluses and minuses. I would say one of the pluses of seeing physicians locally, you know, once you're seeing the person qualified in the area that you need to be seeing them, we live in the community, we're vested. I see you.
Exactly.
I might not recognize you. And I think most patients should find that comforting. When you walk out the door, I probably forgot. I made my notes. I gave you the best recommendations. When I saw you at the mall, I might have recognized you from somewhere, but I don't remember enough to, not that I even would. But so because of the volume, you know, it's not likely that, you know, well, I'm not doing that. But second of all, like I said, we are vested in the community. These are our neighbors, friends, family, countrymen, you know, these are the people we live and work with and amongst. So there's an added pressure, I would say, on some level to perform well. There's always pressure to perform well. But I think the stakes are higher when the patients you take care of are a part of you versus when you go to some place and you're a number. Now, on certain occasions, you will build good, strong relationships with those physicians. And I'm not saying that they're bad physicians or that you will have bad outcomes. I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying that the relationship building is probably going to be a little bit more intense when you're seeing someone who belongs to the community that you belong to, who can relate to you, who can understand the risk factors that you are exposed to, who can understand the challenges that you're up against, and that can maybe help you to navigate how to follow these types of instructions a little bit better in your setting. So pluses and minuses.
And I think that's one of the reasons that we all came back to make a difference, to provide the specialist care that maybe wasn't available a generation ago or a decade
exactly.
ago.
Exactly. True, too. That's true,
so
too.
We went to try to attain the greatest of specialization, to bring back modernization, to be on the cutting edge. Dr. Francis could have stayed in Canada.
Right.
I could have stayed in Germany. You could have stayed in the United States. But we wanted to come back, even though it wasn't always an easy road. But there is a satisfaction in helping our country. We're not
right.
going to give up.
It is about the impact, right? And the evolution. We're sitting here speaking to an endocrinologist, okay? And I believe we have about three of them now in the community. Back in the day, maybe 10 years ago, your endocrine problems was dealt with by an internal medicine specialist.
Right.
But now, you know, as medicine has evolved, the specialties have evolved also. And we have people now coming back. And the only way medicine evolves in the country is when people go, get the experience, the training, the credentials, and bring them back. And that's how we evolve.
Very much so. And no one knows their own people like a fellow Bohemian.
I'm gonna
jump in on your no one knows yourself like the fellow Bohemian, and then I'll circle back to your question about how my experience shaped what I did and why I did it. And I will speak to the local experience, and I will speak to this one experience, which, like I said, highlights how the relationship with somebody culturally similar to you can make a difference. So I have a lot of patients. Let's just use diabetes because we see it every day in all of our specialties, really. And if you don't have diabetes, you're probably 1 or 2 degrees removed from somebody who does. And so a lot of times, let's just say in a scenario where I want my patient to take insulin for whatever reason, the diabetes is not controlled, or I haven't quite gotten them to the goal where I want them to, you know, to be. Let's just say I introduce the idea of insulin. Immediately, the shoulders go down, the fists get balled, the arms get crossed, the head go, you know, the person closes. They are absolutely closed to this idea of taking insulin. Right. Doc, why you won't put me on that? Doc, I ain't going on that unless that's the last thing I have to do. Doc, so here's what happened. Doc, when you go on insulin, you know it bad. So I ain't going on insulin because once you put me on insulin, I know that bad. I say, okay, stop. Where did you get this idea from? Why do you think that insulin is bad? So this is the engagement with your patient. I'm going to find out what is the root of this belief that you have. Well, doc, when granny get put on insulin, everything break down. She couldn't see no more. They'd start moving her toes. 2 months later, she was on dialysis. So when granny went on insulin, the diabetes got bad. So in that particular scenario, that patient is absolutely correct. There is a relationship between when that patient started the insulin and when the complications of diabetes became manifested and obvious to everybody else. What they don't know about granny is that granny's diabetes was uncontrolled for 25 years. Yes. And for the last 10 years, the doctor was negotiating with granny to please let me get this blood sugar under control and add a little bit of insulin to the medications that you are taking. And granny said, I'm putting that in my body, right? And the problem with diabetes complications, they're not visible. For the most part, they are without pain, they are without symptoms, and they were without visibility to anyone looking at you. So if you resist good diabetes control for 25 years, you resist insulin for 10 years, the complications of diabetes, the damage to the blood vessels and the eyes and the feet and the kidneys is occurring under the radar. You're unable to see it. The family is unable to see it. Finally, granny said, all right, Dan, give me the insulin. Diabetes is out of control.
Way out of control.
Kidney function is already so far gone that you don't know that granny is heading to dialysis anyway, but she finally said yes. So what you remember is, granny was fine until she took the insulin. She took the insulin, and 2 months later, she was on dialysis, and this is what happened to her eye. So in your mind, insulin caused the problem. But really, insulin didn't cause the problem. She finally accepted it when the problems had piled up for 25 years. So that cultural sensitivity and that speaking to the patient and taking the time to find out, well, why don't you want to do this thing, uncovered what many patients have admitted was the problem with their idea of taking insulin or any injectable medication. And not all injectables are insulin, but, you know, that's another story.
Yeah, you're so right about that. I mean, we could talk about chemotherapy.
Right. Oh, yeah.
You know, everybody thinks chemotherapy kills people, okay, when chemotherapy saves lives. And the idea is that, you know, a lot of patients come and they're at late stage.
Right.
And that's when you're given this chemotherapy to try and salvage.
Right.
And when you're trying to salvage something, remember, the underlying disease has already gone to the point where it's really damaging that body. And so the person may, you know, progress just as a result of their underlying disease.
Right.
But they got chemotherapy to help. And so then, you know, they then start to say, oh, you know, chemotherapy killed them. But no, it was the underlying disease. And that's what happens in this community a lot. And so the life-saving aspect of chemotherapy, when someone comes early,
right,
they're then, okay, no, I don't want that. When Grammy got a chemotherapy, Grammy died. But Grammy was like stage four, late. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to salvage her. But you're early now, and we're trying to make a difference and cure you. And so we have to have that conversation often, you know? And it's great.
I mean, knowledge is key. That's why we're here. The health of the nation is the wealth of the nation. And we want to see you live better. We want you to see you live longer. And if you have misunderstandings, that can destroy you. It can destroy your health. It can destroy the health of your family. Even, I'll look at prostate cancer, for example. Many men will say, I don't want to know what my prostate cancer statuses or surveillance, because I don't want chemotherapy. I'd rather die than chemotherapy. My granddaddy had chemotherapy and he died. But the main thing I want to say is that if you have early prostate cancer, you have 100% cure rate. If you have organ confined disease, the management of prostate cancer for organ confined curative treatment has no, chemotherapy has absolutely no role. So that's where education is so important. You're afraid of something. You're waiting for that disease to progress, where the thing you're afraid of is the only thing that might actually palliatively give you a few more years on this earth. Taking away that misinformation and that fear of chemotherapy, which has no role in early prostate cancer treatment, curative treatment, then you might have been picked up early and that cure for prostate cancer would have happened in one day, a little bump in the road where you have a near 100% cure rate. So information is extremely important. That's where we're here, trying to impart information and dispel myths and misconceptions.
So I want to circle back to what I had asked before. And the reason why I'd asked it, because there's an excerpt in the book, and I'll read it, right? So that to give context to the question. And it says, a personal journey. One of the most powerful aspects of the experience of authoring this book was the realization that I was writing a book to many versions of myself. Tell us a little bit about that, the versions of yourself that you were writing to.
Okay, so yes, that statement was made when I was going through the process of writing the book and addressing concerns that I see commonly in my juniors, which ultimately, when I looked at them, I was like, oh, gee, I'm looking at myself. So I would say there are moments in training. You know, Dr. Pinto alluded to the fact that it is rigorous. It is grueling. It is gritting. And, you know, and some of that intensity is, I suppose, advantageous or good, considering the grave responsibility that we walk around with every day. But there were moments of fragility. There were moments of, I can't do this. There were moments of crying in the closet. There were moments of all these people walking around here smiling. I don't know how they're doing this. How am I going to get through this? And when I realized that those people were going through their own little battles and that they probably fought those battles in secret and then got themselves together and then came out to ward rounds and got through it. And, you know, then I said, well, if someone had told me that that they were in the closet for 2 minutes screaming before letting it out, you know, venting before they came to me, I might have realized that I wasn't alone.
Right.
So that's not the only part of what I meant when I said talking to different versions of myself, but it was a big part of it. And I think that if I had been given the advice or the insight then, at that time, I might have just had an easier time with coping and knowing that this too shall pass. And so I suppose that's where the transparency came from. You know, the understanding that when you are in that moment, you need to know that somebody else went through that moment or is going through that moment or can help to usher you through that moment.
Okay, good evening. We have another call coming in. This is Urologist Speaks.
Good night. How y'all doing?
Very well, thank you.
Good, thank you.
Good night. Good night, Dr. Parker, Dr. Francis, Dr. Pinto. This is Mangels.
Yes, this is Mangels.
Congratulations on the book, Dr. Parker. And I don't know if I can get an autograph copy, but I look forward to getting it from Amazon.
Thank you very much, sir. I think it might be better
okay.
locally in terms of taxes
Hello?
And importation. If you are local, full disclosure, it's probably better to get it from the bookstore.
Because my Ingalls was one of our nurses. He's away.
Georgia. Amazon. Okay, yeah, Amazon. Because if it's local, it's
my Ingalls, you need to come home.
Oh, that's just Ingalls?
Yes,
that's just Ingalls. What you saying?
Come home.
I'm the number one fan. I listen to this talk show everywhere in the state.
We want you to come home. We want you to come home.
Well, shine your light wherever you are. Shine your light.
Well, thank you for always being our number one fan and supporting us. And yes, we need more good nurses in this country.
Des Michaels, I'll wait for your feedback.
Yeah, we need to pass the Nurse Practitioner Act so I can come back home.
Okay.
Yes,
oh, boy. We got to talk about that one day on the show.
Yes, we do.
We got to bring the nurses on and talk about that. Okay, we'll do that.
I have a lot of colleagues who did nurse practitioner over here. We have some in Florida. Mm-hmm. We have some in Indiana. We have some in Nebraska. A lot of behaviors who did the nurse practitioner program, practicing as family nurse practitioners. And we always discussing the importance of how it could benefit our own country. But I don't know why it's taking so long to be passed. But I guess it's a process.
Yep, it's always a process, but I'm sure it's going to get there.
Yes, sir.
Well, thank you for your call, and thank you for your support.
Congratulations again, Dr. Barker, and I look forward to getting the book.
Thank you very much, sir. I will talk to you soon.
All right, so Dr. Parker, a lot of the book also is, as you say, is very personalized. Can you speak a little bit about the impression of what the public has in terms of, let's even talk about Bahamian society, towards physicians? A lot of it is negative. They have these preconceived notions that, oh, it's the most fantastic life in the world. You have all the money, they're all this and all that. They don't know the grueling and hell that it comes with getting to that point. And just in every day, I mean, you come home, your spouse asks you, how's your day? You internalize a lot of things. You don't want to open up and ruin their mood and say, oh, well, you know what? I had to tell three people they had cancer, or I had to pronounce someone who was dying of prostate cancer in the hospital, et cetera, et cetera. We see a lot of horror. We see a lot of sadness. We see a lot of misery. We see a lot of joy as well. I mean, for me as a urologist, to see someone who 8 years when it was as a, to see a male have male infertility and we'd be able to turn things around so he can have his first child, that's a joy. To see someone being cured of prostate cancer, that's a joy. To see a woman who couldn't cope in her professional life because she had to urinate every 15 minutes, go to be able to safely urinate every 4 hours and not have to wear the pads or the panty liners, etc. So there are positives. There are a lot of difficult times. But what can you tell in terms of what are the myths and what are the misconceptions out there in the community in regards to physicians? First of all, no one becomes a physician because they want finances or economics, because there are easier ways to go and get that. Much easier routes, much easier ways. There are those who do well, but for the mass majority, most physicians are not rich. That is a complete misconception.
Okay, so what misconceptions can we address today? First of all, I would say yes, the book is very relevant to patients because it will help you to see things from your physician's perspective. And it might also help you to understand how you could better communicate with your doctor to get the things from the encounters that you need. Because if you understand where they are coming from and you understand some of the patient scenarios that are discussed, you might feel a little bit more empowered to, you know, advocate for yourself and to be bold and brave about what you are going through. On the flip side of that, we explore many themes about the physician's journey from, you know, undergraduate, sometimes from high school, undergraduate, medical school, residencies, fellowships, training programs. And we talk, like you said, you know, there are better, faster, and easier and more efficient ways of becoming rich. And so the misconceptions are that all physicians are rich, whatever your definition of rich is. And I suppose depending on what your definition is, you know, I don't know. But many of us don't end our careers with an abundance of flow of cash. A lot of us work well into advanced age just to sustain and support ourselves. we spend decades, and it's not an exaggeration, we spend decades training. And so sometimes I would say you spend decades training and you spend hours working. So while you'll be reimbursed for the care that you're given, it's not necessarily excessive compared to the hours of work that you do. And then you said a very interesting thing when you said, you know, sometimes there's hardship, sometimes there's joy. But I think the good physician, I shouldn't even say the good physician. In general, physicians go on journeys with their patients. And sometimes, I'm going to defend some of my colleagues. I'm not talking local, I'm just talking period. I'm going to defend some of my colleagues because, you know, you're a human first. You're human first, you're somebody's child, you're somebody's sister, brother, cousin, friend. And although you are a doctor, you are human first, and that you will remain. And so when you go through a journey with the patient, this could be sometimes you secretly have been through what this patient is going through. Sometimes you openly have been through what this patient is going through. Sometimes you have a sister, a cousin, a friend who's walking this journey, and it takes from you. Caring takes from you. Anyone who's caring for a family member, anyone who is a caregiver understands this more than anybody else, that caring is very taxing. It's taxing physically, it's taxing emotionally, it's taxing financially. So imagine being invested in the care of your patient and giving of yourself daily. Let's just call it 10. Let's just say you had 10 patients a day that you gave yourself to. If you are not pouring into yourself, from whence are you giving? What's the source that you're giving from? You can become emotionally exhausted. I go through some tragedy with my patient. How do you know I'm not crying when the patient leaves the room? But I can't cry 40 times a day.
No.
I will be, you know, the patient themselves will send me in for evaluation. So eventually you have to build up some degree of resistance to the emotional roller coaster. So sometimes you would encounter a physician who might appear to be callous, but this physician has been journeying with patients for 30 years. At some point, they have to develop protective mechanisms to not become so engaged that there's nothing left for them to take home to themselves and their family. So number one, not all physicians are, you know, flourishing in finances. Number two, not all physicians are callous or mean or unhuman or uncaring. Sometimes it's that they have become, you know, I don't want to say hardened. They have developed mechanisms to allow themselves to cope with the myriad of experiences that they have all day. Doctors don't care. Many of us, especially those who practice in public systems, have limited resources. And it could be very emotionally taxing to care for a patient and want to offer them things that you know are standard of care that a patient doesn't have access to. Like sometimes you look at this, you know, you look at Miss Pearl and you're like,
You can't do it.
I can't do it. I don't have the thing. The thing doesn't exist. Right. The thing isn't in the cupboard. It's not on the plane. It's just not here. And so you have to find a way to protect yourself from all of the complications that occur from someone who gives all day. So I would say consider that your patient, your doctor probably cares about you, and that and consider the scenario in which they are practicing.
Yep.
It might not be ideal.
So this hour has gone very quickly.
Wow.
You got to come back.
You definitely need to come back and talk about endocrine issues and more about this wonderful, fascinating book. The book is The Beyond the Knowledge, Power Steps for Doctoring with a Human Touch. Author is our own. Let's support our own. We don't do enough of that in this society.
Absolutely.
Dr. Christine
Parker-Curling.
It's a wonderful read, and congratulations on the success of the book. And continue to make great strides in trying to get this diabetic plague under control in this society.
Yes.
So thank you and have a good evening.
Good evening, Bahamas.
Letting your pencil make you